Hi, friends. Welcome to True Crime Storytime. I'm your host, Ivana Estelle. And I really felt like I should close the celebrity season out with this case. But alas, I have a couple more cases that I really think you need to hear. This case, though, is a story that bound spirituality, impact, rage, and murder. One that I almost didn't think I was equipped enough to tell on my own. Yet, here we are. I want to tell you that this case may seem like it's full of tragedy, but really, there is such love in this story. And I want to start off with that. Lauren London, famed actress, sat almost stoic in the empty restaurant. She sat across TV personality Angie Martinez for a podcast. Lauren's long brown hair was wavy, covering her shoulders. She looked almost angelic in a satin jacket with a satin undertop to match. She wore a pop of lavender eyeshadow and bubblegum pink lip gloss on her full lips. She looked stunning, yes, but that was a given. It's Lauren London after all. It was her demeanor, though, that seemed different. No nerves per se, but an aura of conservativeness, like she was protecting her peace and careful with her words. She started to talk about how, since everything that happened, she was changing. It was clear that she was more reserved. This was July of 2022, which doesn't seem like that long ago at all. Angie, the host, explained how she was looking forward to talking to Lauren about her life since everything. Everything being the passing of Nipsey Hussle. I always wonder to myself what it's like to speak on death that sudden. I've researched and listened to probably over 100 cases, and I always think about what it's like for someone to talk about a person who was gone so suddenly. The death I've personally interacted with always seemed inevitable. The person wasn't stolen from me. But in Lauren's case, that kind of seems like exactly what it's like. I'll have her podcast pinned in my show notes, but I want to get to the point where Lauren talks about she and Nipsey's love. She says that they have a pure love, love that isn't ego-driven. Quote, "I think a lot of relationships are ego-driven and they're not pure. So why would I take myself in this vulnerable state into my ego when I'm trying to get out of it? I'm in death of the ego space. Why do I need another? Why? Does that make my life complete? I'll never get married. Does that mean I'm not of purpose?" Lauren went on to say, quote, "We had pure love, but that does not mean that our egos did not get attached in aspects of our relationship. But we definitely had pure love, always good intention." That type of love is so beautiful, but that's obvious. Moreover, it's rare. It's so hard for us every day to get out of our own way, to dispel what's in our minds, what's ego-driven versus what is our feelings. In fact, this relationship I'm in now possibly is my first that I have ever actively loved someone in every capacity and acknowledged not allowing my ego to get in the way or cloud my judgment. It's not perfect, but I'm trying. That's got to be something, right? I believe a big reason why true crime is captivating for me is the idea of what happens after. This story of these people is so captivating. Yes, I wish I had a better word for it. But it's like whether for a lifetime for those who experience the passing person or the person listening to the case for an hour out of their day, we recognize and connect on some level on the idea that a being was once here and now they're gone. When talking about death, Lauren says she didn't think about it until, quote, "I wasn't in a relationship anymore because of the death." She adds, "A lot of times we are such in our ego that we are in possession of another person. We're not experiencing them. We're not totally loving them and letting them be free. We think we're supposed to be together forever, and that's not a spiritual relationship. A spiritual relationship is without ego. We are together. I bring you up and inspire you, and you inspire me. If there ever comes a point where I am not inspired anymore and now I'm in my ego, and now I feel like I need to possess you. Now I need to control you and you're mine. Then I'm in my ego, and that's not love. There's love in there, but now I'm operating in my ego and not in pure love. I read that over and over, and I'm reminded that there is love in death, and maybe that can put things into perspective. So think about Lauren and their love while I tell the story, and ask yourself about the love you have in your life. Does it carry over lifetimes? This is the story of Nipsey Hussle. There's this concert called Broccoli City Fest. It happens in Washington, D.C. every spring. Every year it rains. That's like a given. To the point where they switched it to July this year. In 2018, tall, slender Nipsey Hussle stood on stage in a red and black tracksuit. His braids were clean and to the back, and he comfortably recited his songs. I was somewhere in that crowd of thousands. I liked his music, and like most girls, I fawned over his perfect skin, cool, calm, and collected demeanor, and West Coast accent. His tattoos peeked out through his rolled up sleeves, and he just looked like he was having a good time, which made us have a good time. He was the last singer before the rain began to come. I stood with my two friends, whom I'd known since middle and high school, one who would become my boyfriend eventually after years of will they or won't they. We'd gone to the festival because I'd begged. I wanted to see Miguel and the Migos. Little did I know, this would be one of Nipsey Hussle's last performances. He was an artist with a cult following, known for thinking out of the box with a demanding presence. I'd imagine you'd sit up straighter when he entered the room. Nipsey was born Ermias Joseph Askedom. Born on August 15, 1958, he was raised in the Crenshaw district of South Central Los Angeles. His mother, Angeli Smith, is stunning, and his father, DeWitt Askedom, was an Eritrean war refugee who came to the United States after fleeing a then-ongoing Eritrean War of Independence. Ermias, who I'm going to refer to as Nipsey for this story, was raised with his brother Sammy and his sister Samantha. I believe Nipsey was the oldest, and he was incredibly close with his family. His dad going by Pop and his mom going by Mommy. The whole family was close with their grandmother, who also lived in California. There's no denying that family was incredibly important to Nipsey. They all just seemed like a team that bonded and rooted for one another. I also partially got the feeling that Nipsey was the glue, that one that interconnected everyone. Although it could have been his grandmother or his mother too. The point is, they were all intertwined and loved each other very much. Nipsey attended Alexander Hamilton High School. It was in the nearby Castle Heights neighborhood and dropped out before graduating. It was around the age of 14 that Nipsey actually left home entirely, joining the Roland 60s neighborhood Crips. They are a cell group of the larger Crips gang, which is primarily based in Crenshaw. Gangs are more so like organizations. Maybe in the future I'll have a podcast episode breaking that down a bit more, but by 2002, when Nipsey was 17, he joined Butter Vision, a creative multimedia digital guerrilla movement. His artistry really began to flourish then. He coined the stage name Nipsey Hussle as a play on the comedian and game show panelist Nipsey Russell. When Nipsey was 19, he went with his father and his brother Sammy on a 3-month trip to Eritrea. This was kind of a rebirthing. He was inspired by his visit and said that it was the beginning of his community activism and entrepreneurial spirit being born. For those of you who are hip-hop lovers, you may recall that upon Nipsey's death, people would continuously say, "The marathon continues." That was paid homage to his music. See, between the years of 2008 and 2010, Nipsey dropped his first mixtape, Sauce and Boy Volume 1. He would go on to work with artists like Drake, Snoop Dogg, and at one point he was signed to Epic Records. But eventually, in 2010, Nipsey decided that he wanted to be independent. He was put on XXL's annual Freshman Top 10. Nipsey then founded his own record label and he released his first mixtape called Marathon. Eventually, there would be a following in 2012. He had a song called Proud of That with rapper Rick Ross. He began collaborating regularly, performing across the country, and in 2013, he'd have his final Marathon mixtape released called TM 3VLAP. He was really huge in LA. All LA rappers knew him, the majority wanted to work with him, and between 2013 and 2019, he released a mixtape called Crenshaw and Victory Lap, which was his first official album. Now, I'm not really big on the music scene, but what I do know is in regards to albums versus mixtapes versus records, what really matters is how people respond to your work. Most people in the mainstream world will know him for creating the F. Donald Trump song in 2016. I say this because he basically was one of the louder speakers against Donald Trump's regime and the racist and violent rhetoric that was now being spewed across the country and causing tensions among basically everyone. Victory Lap was actually nominated for Best Rap Album in 2019. Nipsey had an entrepreneurial spirit. He grew up shining shoes for about $2.50 a day to pay for school clothes when he was just 11. He sold mixtapes out of the trunk of his car and strip malls, and once he had his own label, he experimented with unorthodox sales strategies. He would basically sell expensive copies of certain mixtapes, even if the songs were distributed for free. He founded the Meredith Agency with business partner Karen Civil and George Paget. Basically, they designed the talent-based brand to attract different clients no matter where they were in their careers. Eventually, Nipsey became a silent partner, and that's probably because in 2017, he opened the Marathon clothing store. The store was at the intersection of Crenshaw Commercial District, and it was important because this was his home, and it provided opportunities for getting money into the neighborhood. It was considered something of a smart store. You could buy clothes, of course, but there also was this connection to music and content. Basically, if you were a customer, you had access to exclusive music that you couldn't get anywhere else. It was really kind of genius. It's kind of like taking Spotify and any famous clothing brand you can think of and putting them together. But you can only go to that specific brick and mortar. And the reason that was because that business was supposed to bring money and shed light on the positive parts of Crenshaw. Nipsey was really big on wanting to set an example for the community. In his lyrics, he spoke about violence and the negative impact it had on people. He made a lot of strategic moves in the music industry to show that there is an ability to coexist no matter what you specifically rep. It's how you carry yourself and how you treat people that matters. Even if you weren't specifically a fan of his music, you were a fan of what he stood for. Nipsey was a father as well. He had a daughter named Imani from a previous relationship and a son named Cross with Lauren London. Nipsey and Lauren began dating around 2013. They were known for having a pretty low-key love, but one that most people found genuine. In 2019, things seemed to really be going well. The store was doing phenomenally. Thanks to his entrepreneurial spirit, Nipsey made all of his money from his music streams. So the turn this story is going to take, it's strange. I feel like I've explained a pretty beautiful life. But on March 31st, 2019, everything changed. The end of March to me is always like a surprise. It suddenly dawns on me that though the beginning of the month was freezing because it was finishing off winter, spring was suddenly here. I'm one of those people that definitely is affected by the weather, and I always feel the inkling of hope that good things are coming as the sun stays out longer. March 31st in Crenshaw, California was probably a decent day weather-wise. You know, it's the West Coast. Nipsey was at his store. Foot traffic there was regular, whether you were a Crenshaw native or a fan or someone who genuinely wanted to purchase an item of clothing. On this day, though, Nipsey wasn't necessarily expected at the store. He came by and I'm sure checked on the store, inventory, saw friends, and those who were part of his gang chapter. Listen, I've heard variations before researching this case as to why this murder went down. whispers of it being gang affiliation. I've listened to talks while at smaller get-togethers that Nipsey knew Eric Holder and accused him of being a snitch. I also heard a version that Nipsey Hussle may have been entangled with Eric's girlfriend. I've even heard that it was some sort of setup similar to the assassination of Malcolm X or Martin Luther King. I'm not going to give you a motive, because I don't really know if I have one. But what I can do is start the story off from the eyes of a woman who has to remain anonymous. The chaos after Nipsey was murdered was engulfed in rumors. One in particular was that the man who murdered Nipsey Hussle had a getaway driver, a young woman who was dating him and in on it. Everyone kept saying that she drove this man away or tried to help him at least escape. But that's not true. Not totally. Because of these rumors that have manifested into death threats, this woman and her story has remained anonymous. So I'm going to call her Lisa. And yes, if you dig deep enough on the internet, you can find her real name. But that's not the type of time we're on over here, so don't expect to hear it in this episode. For Lisa, March 31st, 2019 was a regular day. She and Eric Holder drove from Long Beach to Los Angeles to get food and shop. Eric Ronald Holder Jr. at the time was 32 years old. He had brown skin and a hardened face. He usually wore his hair in a short fro. Lisa met Eric in February of 2019. They didn't know each other for longer than a couple of months. During the day, Lisa worked as a home healthcare worker, and at night, she had a job that has been redacted from all records. But it was during that time, in the evening, that she met Eric. Over the course of the next couple months, Eric and Lisa would spend a lot of time together. Lisa would describe their relationship as more of a friendship. They only had sex about one time, although during that time of knowing one another, Lisa was aware that Eric happened to be a part of the Rolling 60s Crips gang. Lisa also learned that Eric carried a black semi-automatic handgun, which she claimed he needed for protection. On March 31st, the pair pulled into a strip mall at Slauson Avenue in Crenshaw Boulevard. This is, of course, where the Marathon store was. Eric told Lisa that he was going to go grab a bite to eat at a restaurant. I'm not sure if Lisa wasn't hungry or didn't want to eat there, or if Eric was a lame and didn't offer to buy her a burger, or maybe they had plans to go somewhere else afterwards, but as they pulled into the parking lot, Lisa saw Nipsey Hussle outside, and she, of course, got really excited. She turned to Eric and said, "Hey, that's Nipsey Hussle." Eric, however, did not respond. Eric didn't indicate to Lisa that he knew Nipsey, nor did he really give any indication that he expected to see Nipsey, which they're part of the same gang. A part of me feels like that would have come up, but maybe not. Eric went into the Master Burger restaurant to order food, and after placing his order, he walked over to a group of three men, one of them being Nipsey. After a few minutes of the four men talking, Lisa was starting to get excited. She was itching to get out of the car and see Nipsey, and eventually, after staring through the glass, she unbuckled her seatbelt and hopped out. As she approached the men, she beelined straight for Nipsey, asking to take a picture. She overheard Eric asking Nipsey if he had ever snitched. Nipsey was pretty calm and waved Eric off as if he did not want to talk to him anymore. Lisa peeped it, but she was more so excited for her selfie. She pressed against Nipsey and lifted her phone to take a photo. After that, she giddily returned to her car. However, Eric was not following in tow. He remained talking to Nipsey and the three other men for a few minutes, and then he walked back into the restaurant. He then left the restaurant and went back to the group one final time for another brief conversation. He then returned to Lisa's car. Once inside the car, Eric told Lisa to drive around the corner. Lisa followed Eric's instructions and noticed that Eric was holding that black semi-automatic handgun. She knew Eric had guns. She'd seen them before. He apparently never left home without it. But why did he have it now? Eric started pulling back on the slide at the top of the gun and told Lisa to drive around the block so he could do a drive-by. At this point, Lisa panicked and absolutely refused. Eric then demanded that Lisa pull into the parking lot located between Slauson and 58th Place. Shaking and nervous, Lisa obliged. Eric got out of the car and told Lisa to wait and not to move. At this point, Lisa panicked. This man has a gun. This is not a Bonnie and Clyde situation. This guy is absolutely insane and dangerous. Eric walked northbound through the alley back towards the strip mall parking lot and approached Nipsey Hussle in the group again. When he was within a few feet of Nipsey, Eric displayed a firearm and fired several shots at Nipsey and two other men who were standing within a few feet from Nipsey. The men, Nipsey Hussle, Kerry Lathan, and Shermie Villanueva, were all struck by bullets and immediately fell to the ground. Kerry was shot once in the back. Shermie was grazed by the waist. These shots were traumatic and also seemed chaotic, but not fatal. It was Nipsey, however, whose shots were purposeful. He was shot 10 times. Eric then cocked his foot back and kicked Nipsey in the head before turning on his heels and running away. This would all be captured on camera. Eric at one point was actually firing with two different handguns, trading between his right and his left hand, and then making his way to the back alley to the car, which then took off. Of course, at this point, chaos ensued. This was in the middle of the day in a public place. By 8 p.m. that night, it was confirmed that Nipsey Hussle had died shortly after succumbing to his gunshot wounds. Now, this comment about being a snitch, it comes up. According to Lisa, she hears Eric say it. According to Carrie and Shermie, they also hear Eric asking about it. But they also suggested Eric wanted to know about his music and wondered if Nipsey had taken a listen to it. Anyone who's seen Hustle and Flow, where Terrence Howard is trying to get Ludacris to play his mixtape, it kind of feels like that vibe. The three men weren't alarmed or nervous or uncomfortable with Eric being there at first, so that could suggest that they knew him or that they didn't view him as a threat. Carrie and Shermie explained that the entire shopping center was essentially family-owned. Businesses were rented out, others were owned directly by Nipsey and his family members and partners. When he was in town, he would come by in the mornings or in the afternoon if he were dropping off his daughter. He dropped by whenever. There was never really any time that was scheduled, actually. See, the next question is, did Eric know that Nipsey was going to be there? Or was this just a chance encounter? Police knew they were looking for Eric, but the question now was, what's the motive? Nipsey himself had even tweeted about having enemies being kind of something you accepted. It could even be considered a sign of a good thing. But this was essentially a mass shooting, or at least you can wrap your head around the idea of it being a mass shooting, but a targeted shooting at the same time. Nipsey also didn't travel with security. This was his home. He wasn't flashy about being there. In fact, that day he had on shorts and a do-rag. He also had another reason to be comfortable. Nipsey knew the people he was around. They were friends and business partners. He even recognized Eric Holder. He actually knew him by the nickname Shitty. And no, I'm not describing what the nickname is. Eric literally was known as Shitty. Some people didn't even know his real name was Eric. He was known as someone that was just around the neighborhood. In fact, when he pulled up with Lisa, it was Nipsey that recognized him first. He asked a friend, "Is that Shitty?" Apparently, though, the group of men hadn't seen Eric in years. Before Eric approached them, Nipsey and the friends were all talking, shooting the breeze, and the demeanor didn't really change initially when Eric walked over. But this is where things get interesting. The men in the group said before Lisa arrived that Nipsey had turned to Eric and was trying to help him. Look out for him, more or less. Basically warning Eric that they have some paperwork on you. I haven't read the paperwork, but you should watch your back. This is where I believe the term snitch is insinuated. See, when I researched this case, I thought paperwork meant something about Eric's music career, but I think Nipsey was referring to something else. See, have you ever been to like a high school reunion or at least run into someone that you used to know back in the day at the like grocery store? That's how I think this conversation started. I think they saw Eric, ask where he'd been, and Eric was kind of low-key about the whole thing. That he'd been out of the way or doing his own thing, and that's when Nipsey brought up the fact that he had heard about this paperwork. Paperwork referring to the idea that Eric may have shared certain private information about the gang to the police. Like he snitched. Paperwork in gang culture normally refers to police reports or court documents. Rumors swirled that Nipsey was accusing Eric, but from witness testimony, it kind of seems like Nipsey was warning Eric, like, hey, there are these rumors that you've been working with the police, and we're part of the same organization, so you better watch your back. It wasn't threatening or demeaning. The whole idea of the paperwork is it can be an opportunity for someone to clear up their name and say, look, here's the papers that I had while in court or in prison. I never snitched on anyone. Or it can be really damning evidence. Then eventually Eric does switch the topic. During their conversation, he says that people are just hating on him, and I guess it's his way of saying the rumors aren't true. Eric then goes on to say that he has a new song out, and he asks the other men if they'd heard it, but they said no. There's some spirituality kind of painted into this story. Some things from Nipsey's own family feeling like something was happening or coming to this very moment. The intuition that one of the witnesses, Herman Douglas, said they felt. That something about Eric suddenly felt unsafe. Herman urged Nipsey to come inside when it looked like Eric had left. Herman couldn't shake the feeling, and though Nipsey said he was cool to stay outside, Herman went into the store and had his lunch. He said that he was eating when he heard gunshots. He recalls leaving the area, looking up and out, seeing Nipsey on the ground and Eric running away around the corner. On April 2nd, 2019, Eric Holder was arrested by the Los Angeles Police Department and held in solitary confinement. By May 9th, a grand jury indicted Eric Holder on one count of murder, two counts of attempted murder and assault with a firearm, and one count of possession of a firearm by a felon. The trial was underway in mid-June. At one point, there was a viral clip of a very famous attorney that worked with O.J. Simpson defending Eric Holder, but I can't find that anywhere anymore. What I do see is Aaron Jansen, who was an L.A. County public defender. He actually attended Howard University, which is even more ironic to think about, especially with DC's response and Howard's response to Nipsey's passing. Also, I'm a Howard grad, so maybe that's why it's only ironic to me. Originally, though, Eric seemed to have had some tie to a higher power attorney, and because of that, it kind of gave off the idea that maybe something bigger had been behind the murder. District Attorney John McKinney served as the case's prosecutor. Eric's attorneys argued that he didn't intend to kill Nipsey Hussle, but acted in the heat of the moment, where District Attorney John McKinney argued that this was premeditated. Although that argument would mean that Eric either was stalking Nipsey Hussle or decided that day, like right before the conversation. Regardless, on July 6th, 2022, Eric Holder was found guilty of first-degree murder and two counts of attempted voluntary manslaughter related to the injuries of the bystanders. By February 22nd, 2023, the Superior Court judge announced Eric Holder was sentenced to 60 years in prison. Prison has not been kind to Eric. Almost every new photo of him shows him with a black eye and a bruised face. He's either in solitary confinement or fighting for his life in general population. However, Nipsey Hussle, as we know it, is dead. He was a father and a brother and a partner and a son and an uncle, so many things. There has been an outpouring love about the significance he's made from countless celebrities giving tributes to sports games honoring him, to a petition to have the intersection of Sausen Ave and Crenshaw Boulevard be named after Nipsey Hussle. In any city, there will be some sort of beautiful painting or mural of Nipsey Hussle. There's one in DC that you can pass when you're in the city, and others all across the country, and especially in California. His funeral was a huge, beautiful affair, the entire Staples Center dedicated to the funeral being completely full. I can't really describe the outpour of love because it's overwhelming. The people from the former President Barack Obama to the former President of Iran, musicians, artists. And from where we started the story, Lauren London, all trying to pay their respects. Nipsey Hussle is gone, but not forgotten. That much is clear. However, his family, being very spiritual people, believe that his soul and his spirit carries on. I've been thinking about what that means more. I've become fascinated with the idea of after. If we come back, do we come back? I'm not at this part of the episode where I try to convert you to anything, but it does make me wonder what's next. I'd like to think that it's something beautiful and ultimately a decision. You stay and you watch over those you love that are still on earth, or you live forever in this peace and light and love. Or maybe eventually you decide to come back and learn different life lessons, experience a new version. Whatever it is, it's bigger than this life. That I do believe. Thank you all for joining me. We are on to our true crime fact of the episode for you to share at the dinner table or water cooler or when you're awkwardly waiting for a Zoom meeting to start. This week's true crime fact is actually one of the nightmares that literally makes me enter my apartment each time with caution. The Golden State Killer, who committed at least 13 murders between 1974 and 1986, was known for breaking into victims' houses, undressing them and then undressing and then standing at the entrance of their bedroom, tapping and scraping his long knife against the door frame until his victims woke up. Thank you so much for joining me this week. All of my sources and photos are on my website, yvonnesl.com. Follow me on all my socials. I will see you next week. We are down to one more case at the end of our celebrity season. I will announce at the end of that episode what our new season is going to be. I also will be posting on social media again. So, as always, safe journey. Keep walking in the light with love. Until next time, Ivana Estelle.